Gentlemen, welcome back. Welcome to another in the Morningstar Men's Podcast series. This week we are back into the Manly Men book, and we're looking at the topic of restoration. We're going to approach it a little bit differently than the chapter does. We're going to approach it from a more universal perspective, and it's this simple premise that in the life of every man, there's going to come the time of temptation where he'll say, I don't think it's worth sticking with this any longer. And a man is either going to select to walk out of a responsibility that he's been called to, that he's been asked to steward, or if he doesn't deliberately walk away from the responsibility, he will sort of let it hang there, unattended to, carefully. And so that's often the case in a man's family circumstances, or sometimes in his business dealings, that he'll do a little bit, do what he absolutely has to, and it's not necessarily even because he is being willfully negligent, but perhaps because he is so engaged in another area of stewardship, and he hasn't yet learned how to balance the various components of life stewardship. So we're going to look at that this morning. We're going to look at how does a man get into that situation. What could a man do to avoid getting into that situation where he needs to find himself, or where he does find himself in a position where restoration is essential? But then if he does find himself in that pit of desperation, that pit of hopelessness, where people that trusted him have now turned away, people that counted on him no longer count on him, and as a matter of fact, they've sort of pushed him out of their lives, when a man finds himself in that pit, and he wants to be back on top, when he realizes that responsibility is actually a good thing, that it's what a man is called to do, how does he regain that responsibility? How does he honorably pursue becoming again the man that he once was? And even more important than that, a man who is perhaps better than he ever was. So I think this will be a very helpful discussion for you this morning, men. And as I so often suggest, if there is a man that you know that's going through something, and I think we all know men like that, if you personally know a man who's struggling with a season where perhaps he has been sidelined through his own either neglect or purposeful decisions, well, why don't you consider sharing this material with him? Perhaps it'll bless his life. See you again next week, man. All right, gentlemen, guess we'll get started. So last week, we opened up with a little bit of a clarification on why we do what we do every Saturday morning. And we talked about the whole concept of life school. And suggested that we are here, hopefully on purpose. Hopefully we're walking in here every Saturday morning with a specific purpose. Does anybody remember what we described that purpose as being? You're obviously exempt. You weren't here last week. Is anybody actually even paying attention? Am I talking to myself right now? All right, we said that the primary purpose why we are all here is to achieve a level of spiritual fitness. Does anybody remember how we define spiritual fitness? Anybody but John, who's nodding his head. All right, spiritual fitness is determined by what? How I respond to the circumstances and situations that come into my life. How I relate to everything in life. And I'll be able to determine how spiritually fit I am based on the quality of my responses. How do I relate to myself? How do I relate to those around me? How am I relating to God? How am I relating to the created order? Okay, so that is the determination of our spiritual fitness. And then we went on from there to say that most of us are probably spiritually fit in some ways, but not spiritually fit in others. In other words, our responses are not as good, and so we need to train to be spiritually fit. Candidly speaking here, what is our typical response to a weakness? When I'm weak in a certain area, what do? Of course, right? And it makes good sense in certain respects. But when it comes to spiritual fitness if I avoid the areas where I do not excel, if I avoid the areas where I'm weak, if I fail to address them, what's going to happen? You'll never grow. That's the upside expression of it. But there's a downside expression of it as well. How many of you have ignored a problem only to find it get worse? How many of you had a tire that was 5 pounds low on air and you saw that, you walked out into the driveway one morning, there it was, and you said, I need to get some air in that. Have you ever been along the side of the road thinking to yourself, boy, I wish I would have put air in that. All right, sometimes when we avoid confronting a small problem, it becomes a bigger problem. So I thought today we'd continue that discussion for a few minutes, the idea of why are we doing what we're doing, because I realized that not everyone is here because they're intentional about being spiritually fit. There are some other things that we do here. And so here's the first thing that I think we offer. And we don't all come in the door because we're looking for this. But how many of you have ever been in a situation where it was difficult to find hope? Now, what's my normal response when I have no hope? Well, you can't tell me what my normal response is, so let me rephrase the question. What is your normal response? Okay. I'll feel sorry for myself. What else?
We can isolate.
We isolate. In other words, at the point when you might most need some affirmation, a fresh perspective, a different way of looking at things, you're going to isolate. Now, here's the interesting thing. When you live inside your own head for very long in a hopeless situation, what's the narrative that you tell yourself? It only gets worse, doesn't it? The more I dwell on things with the thinking that I already have, and remember, sometimes it's my own thinking that got me into this situation, so the more I isolate, the only person I'm around is myself. And myself is one of the key people that got me into this hopeless way of thinking, and so my prescription for that is what? To isolate so that the only person who has influence over my life is me. That seems not to be a very productive method. And so one of the reasons that I hope we come here is because from time to time, each of us experiences a season of hopelessness. So let me go on from there and say the only way that you and I can break out of that hopeless cycle is if we're willing to show up in the presence of other people and get some affirmation. And that's extremely difficult. This is why we do this together. Remember how we described school last week as the Greeks envisioned school? School was a time where people who were normally at work set aside time to be intellectually refreshed and challenged. They came together both to hear from someone, but to interact with the material and interact with each other. Hope rises as I am among other people who have a different perspective and may have a hope-filled perspective. You're not going to increase your reserves of hope if you stay home. On the other hand, when you and I walk in the door, are we on the lookout for people whose hope may be depleted? So when you come here, I don't want you only to come here because you want to get more spiritually fit. I want you to come here because you're aware of the fact that today may be the day that you have an encounter with someone who needs a little bit of hope and you're God's solution to that situation. All right, so that's one reason. Well, here's another one. That's a G. There. That's a worse G than the first G. Healing. Have you ever been spiritually wounded? Let's think of wounds and injuries. So wounds are inflicted by others, typically, hopefully. Injuries are the result of day-to-day living and the stresses of life. So think quickly with me. What are some ways in which you and I can be spiritually wounded? Have you ever been wounded by an individual? Okay, what does that look like? How did they do that? I mean, not the details, But what's the general circumstance there?
We felt they could trade possibly.
Okay. Anybody else? Remember, wounds inflicted perhaps by the stressors of life, by other people, injuries are the result of being out in the work world, in the spiritual world every day. So how can I be spiritually injured? Have you ever been fatigued? Have you ever put yourself out beyond what you were capable of? Have you ever extended yourself to the point of exhaustion, perhaps after you should have taken some time to recover? In the same way that there is a need for physical healing and therapy that helps with that, there's need for spiritual healing. So coming together here is a type of spiritual therapy if you'll allow that to happen. All right. Obviously, we do an education component. So why do we do that? See, you guys should be able to teach this stuff. You should be able to give me better answers than I'm able to give you by now. Why do we need education?
Truth needs to come up.
Okay. Remember this path that we've said. I can't believe what I don't know. Right? If I'm unaware of something, it is impossible for me to believe it. There was a time when each of us was not fully acquainted with the message of the gospel. And when we lived in that ignorance, we did not know how to correctly respond to the gospel. Do you feel that you've mastered all that? Now, here's the amazing thing. If one of you could put your hand up and say, at this moment in time, I believe I have learned everything that there is to learn about how to relate to my world, to God, and to myself. I believe that I have mastered everything that there is. Tomorrow would be a different day. The world would be different. You would be different. God would be the same. But every circumstance in your life would be slightly different. And therefore, you would have to learn different or new methods for relating to life. Bill just came to me with a question this morning. I'm not going to share the question, but it was a difficult question. And what that told me is that Bill, at this moment in his life, is grappling with something that he has not had to struggle with in this way at this time before. Don't we all find ourselves in that situation? Well, where are you going to get the information that you need? We come to a place like this so that we can receive that information, because tomorrow's struggles are different than today's. All right, a couple more here. All right, this is an uncomfortable one. The first part sounds good, it's a challenge. But the second part is not so much good. How many of you have ever been upset with something you heard here? How many of you have ever been irritated with something you've heard here because it didn't feel good?
Well, yeah. Things I've said, you've said, church, if we're not, something's wrong. People were upset with Jesus, nothing said.
There are times when we need correction. Now, here's the thing. There's two places you can get correction. You can get correction from people who flat out don't care about you, or you can get correction from people who at least care about you. And I'm not saying that the correction from people who care about you feels marvelous, but at least you know that the intent is right. Have you ever received rebuke or correction from someone whom you know didn't care about you? They were correcting you for their purposes. So my hope is that we come here and at times we need to be corrected, but at least you'll know that the environment in which you're receiving the challenge or correction is one of love and concern. All right, so suppose now you're recovered. Your hope tank is full. You've gotten some spiritual therapy, so you're back to your spiritual old self, so to speak. You've learned some new things that are going to help you to think in different ways, believe different ways, respond in different ways. You've been challenged to respond, but you still don't know exactly how to do something. Have you ever felt God's call to do something, but you weren't quite sure about the steps necessary to do? Well, the answer is yeah. And so at times, we need what we'll call equipping. Now would be a good time to stop and remind you of something. I ask every one of you all the time, invite other guys here. Not because I really care how big the crowd is here, but because you and I know men who could probably use some of what we do here. I want you to have a whole list of things as to why you show up here. I'm giving you your list. I'm really not giving you your list. I'm really helping you to think through the list that you already know, but maybe you've never taken the time to think, why do I show up here? So, what I just said was a form of equipping. You go out into your daily life. Maybe you see somebody here on a Sunday morning and you say, well, I'd like to invite them. And they say, well, why do you go there? What do you get out of it? Exactly what do you get out of waking up at, 6:30 in the morning so you can be somewhere at 7:30 on a Saturday morning? Personally, I like to sleep on Saturdays. Why would you waste that time going there? What do you say? I mean, apart from, well, they have great Boston cream donuts, because Yum Yum sells them at 10 o'clock in the morning too, so you could go after you've had some extra sleep. I want you to know why you're here. And finally, inspiration. So inspiration is that something that you're given that calls you to act after you've been equipped. Sometimes it's just that little extra nudge that says to you, in your spirit, I can do it. I believe that God can help me to do it. All right, so if you were writing them down, you've now just lost your chance. All right, now that you're in good practice for listening to me talk, I hope that your own minds are warmed up so that you'll be able to participate in the next section. All right, so we're going to talk about restoration this morning. Obviously, if you're following along in the Manly Men book, there's more chapters, there's more topics than we're going to cover. So I've handpicked the ones that I felt would be most helpful. So, restoration, what do you think of when you think of the word restoration? What's that?
Rebuilding and repairing.
Okay, rebuilding and repairing. Any other thoughts? Rebuilding. Did you?
Repairing. Repairing.
Okay, all pretty good answers. We're going to see what component of them is accurate and what is somewhat inaccurate. But there's an assumption underlying this. How many of you have ever had a toothache? Bad headache. And then you woke up one day and it was gone. Well, maybe that's not how the toothache got gone. Maybe you had to go to the dentist and endure more pain before the pain went away. But so you've all experienced that, right? How many of you, after it was all gone, you woke up the next day and the headache was gone and the toothache was gone, say to yourself, boy, I wish I could be restored to my former self when I experienced that pain. So we don't think that. So what else is embodied in the thought of restoration? It is a return to something that you want, that you realize is good. Well, then, here's the question, and we're going to refine our understanding of restoration. We're going to say that the type of restoration that we're referring to is a restoration to something which I abandoned a commitment to. All restoration, as we're understanding it this morning, is a stewardship issue. Something has been given into my care, into my charge, and for whatever reason, I've decided that it wasn't worth the toil. It wasn't worth the price I had to pay. It wasn't worth the effort to be the steward of that thing. Now, that should be pretty sobering. And incidentally, we're doing this not because I'm expected, I'm looking at a room full of people who have all walked away from their responsibilities. But we're doing this because I believe that there is not a man alive who will not go through at least one period, perhaps a long period in his life, where he will either be tempted to walk away from a responsibility. In all probability, most men walk away from one or another responsibility, and if not walk away from it, and we're going to look at the difference between two things, there are responsibilities that I flat out just walk away from. There are responsibilities that I ignore. I just don't treat them with the seriousness that they deserve. And when I don't treat a responsibility seriously, by default, it slips away from me. So all restoration presupposes that there is something that was good that has been entrusted into my care, but through neglect or deliberate strategy, I've allowed that stewardship to slip or to slide. So can you think of something right now? Think of something that maybe you've been tempted to walk away from. Think of something that you could walk away from. And it's easy to see it in marriage, isn't it? Like, we go into marriage with one set of assumptions about how it's really going to be, and then we find out, perhaps 5 or 10 or 15 years into the marriage, that it's not at all like we thought it would be. And at that moment, we're tempted to walk away. Why do we walk away? What's that? Don't feel like putting the effort.
Fear of failure, or maybe we've experienced some failure in that before. We don't want to go back to that.
Okay. Failure. Fear of failure.
Whether it be walking away or fixing it, it's really kind of an adaptation to an acceptable state.
Bring me more on that.
Well, say, well, let's go back to the tooth. Once the tooth is gone, you're dancing to a new state that's acceptable to you.
Okay.
It's the case of leaving a spouse, you're adapting.
Okay. Now there's an interesting thing that he said there. And here it is. Remember what we said? All restoration is a return to a stewardship, so there is a direct correlation between stewardship and restoration. My need to be restored to something, in addition to presupposing that the thing was good, also presupposes that I did not perceive the value in that stewardship at the time, and therefore the price that I would have to pay in these things was not worth what I perceived it to be worth. And what I could gain by walking away was greater than what I could gain by staying in it. Do I need to repeat that? The difficulties that I perceive in staying in this stewardship charge are greater than the benefits to me of staying in the stewardship charge. And just let that settle in, because this is something we're all pretty good at doing relational math. We really are. What's the cost-to-benefit ratio of being in this relationship? What's the cost-to-benefit ratio of being in this job? Let's make it even more personal, huh? What's the cost-to-benefit ratio of paying my bills on time? Well, there's one. Let's just park on that one for a moment. What are the benefits to not paying your bills on time? Yeah, what are the benefits to not paying your bills on time? Exactly, you do, don't you? You can do lots of really cool, fun stuff for a little while. Right? For a little while. And then what happens? Well, then reality sets in. That illustration is so obvious, isn't it? Well, let me ask you a question. Why do men walk out of marriages? It's the exact same thing, isn't it? It's just that the time factor is different. See, when you don't pay your bills, within a month or two, you're pretty aware of the fact that the fun is over, right? And the reality is coming back to roost. But if you walk out of a marriage, how long does it take before you're aware of what you've walked out on? Sometimes it happens within months, sometimes it's years, sometimes it's 10 or 15 years before the total reality of what you've done settles in. So I think my first objective here this morning is to make us all aware of the fact that if we don't neglect stewardship responsibilities, we don't need restoration. Just think about that. If I do the difficult things when I'm called on to do them, I might not need to do the even more difficult things later on. Remember the tire in the driveway? 5 pounds low on air? Okay, is there a cost to putting air in the tire then? Of course there is. You might have to open the garage door. I mean, let's say it's like that. Let's say there's 3 inches of snow on the driveway. Let's say it's 15 degrees out there. And let's say you're borderline late for leaving for work. Is there a cost to putting air in the tire then? Yes, there is. Of course there is. Right? Understand this. It's exactly the same as with sin. Men aren't idiots. You're not an idiot. You don't choose to walk away from a responsibility because it seems smart. We all choose to walk out of responsibilities because the pain at the moment seems so great that it doesn't seem that the pain later on could possibly be worse. The tire. It's 15 degrees. You're fumbling around with the valve stem and the little black cap that's on the valve stem. And your fingers don't work because it's 15 degrees. And the cheap air compressor that you got from Sears as a Christmas present last year really doesn't work all that well. And it's taking forever to put air in the tire. And then maybe you're not really good at putting air in the tire, so it seems that half the air is leaking out the sides. And the wind is blowing. And your mind is racing toward that cup of coffee that's waiting for you somewhere, and you know you're going to be late for work. Now tell me that similar scenarios haven't happened to you. And we all entertain the idea of walking away from a responsibility because the pain in the moment is greater than we perceive the pain in the future to be. Why do we buy with credit cards? And I don't mean month to month, but I mean, why do we buy with a credit card what we can't afford to pay cash for? The exact same thing in reverse. We perceive the benefit now to be greater than the pain that we will suffer later. What do you know about that being true? Hey, don't we all know? Those of us who have more than a few years of experience, don't we all know that that's not true? That sometimes in the end, the long-term payment price is worse? We'd have been better off to just wait? All right, so let's take a look at some of the things that we lose, some of the things that we want restored to us. So there's a list down there. Midway down the first side of the first page, we lose position. Incidentally, these are all stewardship trusts. What's next? Opportunity. Before we go any further, let's unpack some of them. Can you think of a position that you want? don't mean a job title. Think in the broadest of terms. Can you think of a position that you want? Give me an example. All right. How about father? What do you want to be said of you as a father? What about, I'm going to have to use an adjective with this, but creative employee. Or employer. Any other positions? I mean, come on, we all have positions that we would like. When we walk away from a stewardship, we abandon that position, and it's only after we don't have the position anymore sometimes that we want it back.
Freedom.
Ooh. Freedom.
Respect.
All right, we're just going to have to... You know what? I'm out of room. That's it. Freedom and respect. Okay, let's move down. What about opportunity? You've walked away from a situation... You've walked away from opportunity. Give me an example of that.
I'm not deciding whether to do something or not until the moment passes by.
Do you remember the story in the book of John Mark? And he sets out with Paul and Barnabas, and he makes it partway through the journey. And it would be reasonable to assume, usually when people went out on what we'll call some sort of missionary journey, they went as a group for a number of reasons. One of those reasons was that somebody needed to attend to the day-to-day needs of that team. In other words, to put it in blunt terms, somebody probably needed to do some day work everywhere that they went in order to earn money for food. Somebody needed to attend to living arrangements. Somebody needed to do all those basic things. Well, so here's John Mark. He's been away from home for a while. Maybe he's a little homesick. Maybe he's a little uncomfortable. I mean, let's just be practical. Maybe he's consumed some bad water, eaten some bad food, and he's got some sort of intestinal virus. We don't know. The guy is just tired of being on the road, being away from home, attending to the day-to-day responsibilities of being part of this missionary team. See, we got to paint a real picture here. This wasn't just a guy in a Sunday school story. This was a real guy, and he chose to abandon his responsibility for a reason.
He was pretty young, too. So he didn't have a lot of life experience.
Did he give up an opportunity? See, because in the company of those more experienced men, what were the benefits that he could have acquired? What were the benefits that he might actually have been receiving but he wasn't aware of at the time?
Wisdom.
Yeah, the wisdom of being in the fellowship with other people. Watching what God was doing that he'd probably see in no other way. Do you think there's things you can see while you're traveling with a group of God's people that you might not see back on the farm? Probably. What else? Come on, we're men, we understand this. How many of you want to be the manager of something before you put in your dues just as one of the workers?
Experience.
Yeah, experience. So many opportunities here. But in the moment, the pain of the stewardship was greater than the perceived opportunity that you'd get in the future. Responsibility.
Sincerity.
Yeah. Think about responsibility in this way. Have you ever longed for vacation? Been on vacation for, I don't know, I'm going to say 2 weeks. I don't know what a 2-week vacation is like, but... What do you start to feel like at the end of a week and a half? Yeah, it's time to get, right? I don't think I can stand one more day of lying on the beach. I know this food is great, but I don't think I can eat one more good meal.
I don't think I've ever said that. About February, we're sort of thinking that way. We keep over the beat.
Can't afford one more good
meal. Yeah, right. I can't afford one more good meal. Do you believe that the things that God has placed in your hands as trusts for you to steward and care for can bring satisfaction to you? Because that's another one of the lies that we buy into when we walk away from responsibility. The satisfaction that I will get from pursuing my own pleasure is greater than the satisfaction that I will get when I manage the responsibility that God has given me. And I'm not trying to turn that into some cheesy church statement. We know this to be true. We are actually kind of like built so that we are most satisfied, most contented when we are pursuing meaningful work. Try sitting around for a month and doing nothing. Where's the satisfaction in that? Remember the Genesis account? It was good, it was good, it was good, it was good. How does God get the privilege of being able to say it was good at the end of every one of those cycles?
He worked.
Because he worked first so that he could sit back and observe that it was good. Have you ever experienced work and said to yourself, in the moment, this is not good? While working, yeah, we do that. And so when we allow the immediate to fog our vision so that we don't see the long-term perspective, when the immediate pain or difficulty fogs or clouds our vision so that we cannot see the long-term benefit, we're prone to walk away. Incidentally, that's why at times we need to come to something like this, so that we get a hope recharge, so that we get a refreshing. Reputation is something that sometimes we want back. What do those closest to you think about you? Actually, now would be a good time. It's later on in the material here, but it might be a good time. Understand whose reputation or whose opinion matters. Your reputation is what other people perceive you to be. Whose perceptions matter and whose don't? Do you know that? Whose opinions about who you are matter the most? See, because we weigh this stuff on a scale every day. Do I want the person at work to think more of me? Or do I want my family to think more of me? Do I want people in the community to think highly of me? Or would I perhaps prefer to have God think of me with favor? Whose opinions do I value most? And sometimes when we go after the admiration of the wrong group of people, it takes us to situations where we walk out of stewardship responsibilities and only afterwards we find out that, you know what? My reputation with them really wasn't all that important a thing. My reputation with the people who I pretty much devalued is perhaps more important than my reputation with the other people who, as soon as I can't perform the next magic trick, won't care about me anyway. This is most certainly a stewardship. Let me explain it this way. When something is yours and you own it, you can treat it however you want. Have you ever bought a new toy? Just think of the toy that you couldn't wait to have. Whatever it was, I don't know. Maybe it was a new car, maybe it was a new boat, maybe it was a house somewhere or whatever. Have you ever wanted something a lot? But once you have it, it doesn't quite mean as much to you? And then you start to use it less and care for it less. And so that pretty soon the thing that you couldn't wait to have is just collecting dust somewhere. Have you ever experienced that? All right, now think of it this way. Has someone ever given you something to care for? You didn't go get it. It's not yours. It's not yours to do with as you want. Someone that you think a lot of and who thinks a lot of you gave you this thing, gave it into your trust and said, while I am away, would you please care for this? How are you going to look after something like that? Differently? I think so. When we think of relationships as ours, we're liable to devalue them. When we think of the relationships in our lives as stewardships, as people whom God has placed into our care and in our trust, it throws a whole new light on how we care for each other. What kind of wealth do we have? What kind of wealth do we have that we can walk away from? Any thoughts? I mean, obviously there's money that we can want. But there's surely other kinds of wealth.
Friendship.
Yeah, friendship. Any others? So ultimately, you see where he went?
Church.
Okay. Which is a form of relationship. We can connect these two. All stewardships, in one way or another, involve responsibility and relationship. This is why I should not be trusted with the marker. I scribble all over everything. Responsibility and relationship. If you got a spare spot on that paper, you should write that down. In the end, every stewardship involves a responsibility and a relationship, and every need for restoration is an indication that in one way or another we have abdicated a responsibility and walked out of a relationship or devalued a relationship. And finally, we can look at the last two is joy and peace. These are things that we sometimes want back only after they're gone. All right, let's stop for a moment and let's have some interaction with what we've already seen. Does anybody have any questions, any comments about anything? Yeah.
I don't know, I could be wrong, but do you think we could add to the list there, the dream, about our personal dream?
Yeah.
Society tells us today that dreaming is childless, but if you don't have a dream, if you're not focused on the vision, you want to go, you lose out on it.
And that's really good because in the short term, pursuing a dream is frankly difficult when it gets down to the nuts and bolts of actually taking it from this idea in my head to a strategy for its accomplishment. And the difference between a dream that will happen one day and a dream that becomes something that's strategized and becomes more tangible is a lot of work. It's a lot of work. Every once in a while, when I'm in there and I stand at the back and I think to myself, boy, what was it like 9 years ago, 8 years ago? And I think about standing in the back of the B Kids room, I guess. I think about standing in the back there and the difference between where we were and where we are. Was there a lot of work in the middle? Was there a lot of temptation to quit or give up? There might have been. And this, incidentally, I'm glad you brought that up. This is a stewardship trust that has been given to us.
It's also kind of connected to position or opportunity, too. The dream is in position before it. The table of opportunity leads it to fulfill the dream.
Yep. Okay, so now that we see what we have to lose, what we might want back, let's talk about the reality. Because men walk away from the responsibility, men walk away from the relationship. Remember what we just said, stewardship in the end involves some sort of trust connected to a responsibility or a relationship. And when people walk away from that, they have regrets. So here's an interesting statistic. You can take your single page diagram charty thing and the line on the left, I want you to write the word baseline above that. That is where you were. And that baseline applies in all three of these. I'll get into explaining that a little bit more, this whole diagram a little bit more in a few minutes. But so the baseline is where you were before you made the decision, either by default, which is where you just ignore the responsibility and let it kind of slip out of your hands, or by conscious choice, John Mark, when he decides, I'm not going to stay with these guys anymore, I'm going to go home, I'm going to go home to my own warm bed and see my family because I'm tired of being on the road as some migrant missionary all the time. This life isn't for me. So John Mark chooses to walk away from something, but just as probably many of us will just choose to allow a responsibility to just linger in some sort of, I don't know, zone of unawareness. And then one day we wake up. If you look at the back page, you can see a cycle here. Failure to understand or appreciate what we have or an unwillingness to pay the tough price as to keep it. You are the man. Do you remember a few weeks ago when John talked about Thanksgiving? And when we fail to be thankful for what we have, when we fail to see the good in what we have, we are more likely to walk away from it. Remember that. When you don't appreciate what is right there in front of you, it's more easy to buy into the scenario you tell yourself that there is something better out there for you. I want to go back to the garden story that is just a great example of stewardship. And we're going to visit it a couple of times. Why is Eve able to buy into the serpent's story? See, when I'm not appreciative and grateful and thankful for the opportunity that is right there in front of me, I can be prone to buy into a story about how I could have something better. Whenever you say to yourself or to anyone else, what God has given me in the moment is not enough for me, I deserve something more, you're on shaky ground. And I'm only saying that as a warning because I need to warn myself because, yeah, it's easy for me to say that exact same thing. I want you to understand that. There's no judgment here. Because I would venture to say that every one of us has said that. What God has given into my care, the responsibilities that He has given to me, the relationships that He has given to me are not as good as the ones that I really could have. God hasn't done a very good job of giving me what I deserve, and so therefore I'm going to go out and get something else that I deserve. And in the process of going out to get what you think you deserve, you have to give up something that God has given into your care. Thanksgiving for what you already have is a great antidote to that. Because thanksgiving will force you to see the good even in a difficult situation. I mean, it seems idiotic, right? What fool would thank God for the marriage that it's really difficult? Huh? That doesn't seem to make much sense. Thank you, God, for the fact that we come home and we fight every day. Wow, that's great. I won't even get into some of the other details. Thank you, God, for what I don't have. Thank you, God, for this thing and that she is or she isn't or whatever. You ever met somebody who walked out of a marriage and regretted it?
I met a lot of guys. They wake up and they're repenting and I want to come back and all that. And she's way past that.
And so this is sort of just a precautionary word, and I use marriage not because I'm singling that out, if that happens to be your issue. I'm using marriage because it's easy to see that, and it's easy to see the consequences of that. And like John just said, we can see it so often in the world around us.
Did you say the same thing about him too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Take time to thank God for what you have. Even if it's work.
There's a reason for these stupid cliches we have in life that are biblical, but grass isn't always greener on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all those sayings, and there's some truth to these sayings. You can always start looking, look at that.
Well, and what did we already say? It's exactly like sin, right? There's pleasure in sin. You can't deny that. Sin is fun, otherwise nobody would be drawn to sin. Temptation wouldn't be tempting if it wasn't tempting. Well, in the same way, no fool walks away from responsibility that's meaningful and rich and which he's deriving satisfaction from. We only walk away from things that are difficult. Why does John Mark walk away from the responsibility that he has? Because, It's very hard. Parenthetically, let me insert this. Do you want to see God in your life at some point? Before you die, would you like to see God at work in a way that you would have to say, you know what, that's God, it couldn't have been me?
Sure.
How are you going to see that? How am I going to see that? How are you going to know it's not you? Have you ever had a situation where it was maybe God, but maybe it wasn't? I mean, you're pretty good at what you do, so you think it was God, but maybe it wasn't? Am I the only person in the room who understands what I just said? Because I'm getting all these foggy mists. But what if you were in a situation that was so tough, so out of your depth, that the only way that it could work was God? What if you were in that kind of a situation? All right, what does it feel like to be in that kind of a situation? It's uncomfortable. It's more than uncomfortable. Let's just say it. It sucks.
You feel helpless.
You do. And you want it to end. Look, we're not idiots. We're wired to avoid pain. Are we not? Stick your hand in a meat grinder. Do you want to keep it there? No, we're wired to avoid pain. The truth is that the only way we can see God in big ways, though, is if we are in over our depth and perhaps experiencing pain. Thank you, God, for the pain in my life. Yeah, that doesn't seem like a sensible prayer of thanksgiving. All right. Number two. We're going to assume that you walk away from the responsibility because we're talking about a cycle. When I fail to give thanksgiving for something, when I fail to appreciate what I have. Incidentally, maybe now will be a good time. Let's turn over to the book of Lamentations. It's been a while since we've been there. Just turn over to the second chapter, and then we're going to come back to the notes, and we'll get into Lamentations in just a moment. Immediately after you walk away from a responsibility, there's liable to be a time where it feels great. So now we're going to go back to that chart that you have, that single page chart where I had you write baseline. So the top black one represents your cycle of walking away from something, abdicating something, and being restored if you choose to. The first cycle, the first gray, represents a stakeholder, which is the person who you have walked away from. In this case, you walk away from the responsibility. Let's think about a marriage because it's easy to think that. The day that the guy gets up, packs his bags and leaves, is that the first day he's thought about that? Was that a whim? He came home at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and said, I think I'm going to just leave my wife today. How long has that been going on?
walked through that scenario a lot of times.
He has. He's gotten ready for it. And that's why, if you'll notice, the baseline in the black chart is shorter. The baseline is shorter there than it is in the second one, because the people that you walk away from are not aware of the fact that you're going to walk away. And so their baseline of safety, security, whatever it is longer. Because you've disengaged a long time before you actually walk out the door. Before they are aware of the fact that you're going to walk out the door, just like John said, you've rehearsed that scenario hundreds of times. You have disengaged from that relationship months before you actually walk out the door. And so there's a certain liberation that takes place in your mind. Now go down to the bottom gray. In the bottom gray, instead of you just one day out of the blue seemingly to the stakeholder walking out the door, the bottom scenario represents one where you have just ignored a responsibility. There's no thought of getting divorced. You're just not managing your family well. You're not home, or you're disengaged while you are home. But you don't know it. And that's why the baseline there, your black baseline, number one, which is you, that's longer. Because you're not aware that everything in that stewardship that's been given to you has been deteriorating for a very long time. The people that you are to care for, the people whom God has given to you as a trust, they're acutely aware of it. And that's why in their minds, there's been a long, slow, gradual plunge into despair that's been taking place long before you're aware of it. Does that make sense? I wish I could do this in live time and you could see the lines move and overlap. I did the best I could given the fact that I started it at 10 o'clock last night, so you'll have to excuse that. But now we return to us, which is black line. And so you and I plunge into this period of despair where after we've lost something, we recognize that we've lost it. So think about John Mark. What does it feel like the day he leaves Paul and Barnabas? Be honest, what does it feel like? Feels good. I got people waiting for me at home. All right, it's going to be a long walk, but boy, it feels good not to have to worry about these guys, not to have to meet their demands. What does it feel like the day you walk out of your marriage? Boy, this feels good. I'm free. It's the first time in 15 years I can breathe the fresh air, the invigorating air of freedom. It's good. There is a period of joy and delight, happiness, not joy, happiness and delight that often takes place when you walk away from a responsibility. You ever heard that phrase, you don't know what you've got till it's gone? But there's a gap in between there. You don't know what you've got till it's gone, and you realize how valuable it was. Which returns us to the idea of Thanksgiving. If you could only take the time in advance to realize what you did have and give thanks for what you did have, you wouldn't have to experience the pit. All right, I keep circling around this idea and I never get to it, so we're going to talk about it now. The statistics are alarming. Depending on what country, what ethnic background, depending on a bunch of different variables, the suicide rate among men as compared with women, men are somewhere from 3 to 10 times as likely to kill themselves as women are. In other words, men who have found themselves in the pit of hopelessness and despair are very poorly equipped to deal with it. Now, I want you to just let that settle in for a moment. What does that say about us as men? Now, there's an interesting additional statistic. It's kind of funny. Women attempt to kill themselves more than men. They're just not successful at it. Because women are not willing to execute that final step in a final sort of a way. Women tend to want to medicate themselves into oblivion. as opposed to men who will either, and I hope this isn't depressing anybody that we're talking about this, but men will tend to either take a gun to their head or hang themselves. According to one statistic, the most popular form of suicide in Europe among men is to hang yourself. I know I promised you some hope today. Well, the hope is that... the hope is this. The hope is that the reason that women... another one of the reasons that they theorize that women end up being more effective at dealing with things is that while they'll walk around in this chronic state of depression because they feel their emotions more richly and fully, they also have more connection to other women. Men tend to isolate... we've already talked about that, but I want to talk about that in the context of this specific thing. Men tend to isolate themselves from each other at their point of hopelessness. Now, why do they do that? Because a man will typically walk away from a responsibility, and the responsibility is in some way connected with his community. Where do we find our richest friendships and relationships? Now, I know at first blush we all would like to say, oh, well, we find them in church. And over a period of time, if a man has been a follower of Christ and connected in one church for 10 or 15 years, that can be true. But friendships generally form among those whom we spend the most time with. Would you agree with that? Who do we spend the most time with? People at work. Have you ever failed at work? Have you ever walked out of a work responsibility? And think about this. If I fail in a situation at work, the very people that I might turn to, whom I hoped would be my friends, are maybe the very people that I failed. If I fail in a family situation where I come to an awareness of the fact that I've done my family poorly by not being a good steward of them, am I going to be able to turn to my family for comfort? They're the very people whose trust I've betrayed. Where do I turn when I am a man and the very sources of relational comfort that I might turn to are the same things that I have now betrayed? To whom do I turn? And this is why men feel this pain so acutely. Men struggle to make relationships a little more than women. That's not universally true. But men can struggle to make rich relationships. The relationships they do make are often connected to the very areas where they are greatest stewards and therefore most prone, when they fail, to break that tie. Now here's the other unsettling thing, and this should be a warning to us all. I said we would go back to the garden again. Where is Adam's point of failure? Is Adam's point of failure in his work or in his family? It is. It doesn't say that Adam neglected to care for the garden well. What's implied in the story, though not specifically stated, it is never specifically stated, but it is implied that Adam did not somehow shepherd his wife well. And in the process of failing that, we find ourselves in this difficult situation.
And we see God addresses Adam first, calls for Adam first. Adam has that responsibility.
Another cautionary tale. Men will typically invest all manner of effort in making sure that they don't fail at work. Remember that list that we put on the board before? Reputation, opportunity, all those other things. What was the list? Position, opportunity, reputation, wealth. Where does a man usually think that he finds them? Certainly not at home, right? When's the last time you came home at the end of a hard day and the wife and kids met you at the door and said, "Thanks, Dad. Oh, honey, you're the bestest." Can you remember when that happened last? And so the one place that a guy doesn't want to fail is at work, and that's where he'll double down on his efforts. Be Because that's where he receives the things that he hopes to receive in life. All right, back to the cycle. Finally, there comes a time of recognition where you start to realize what you've lost. And this is that pit part. This is the part where the mind goes to, well, maybe if I can't fix the problem, I'll just end the problem. The fastest way to end the problem, as we've already said, is I'll just end my life. What are some of the... Would anyone here be bold enough to say that I have gone through a period like this? I have walked out of a responsibility, or I've let a responsibility slide, and because I've let that responsibility slide, I've found myself in this pit situation. You find yourself in a difficult predicament right now, don't you? Because you have a story to tell, but you don't like to talk. How's that going to work? Would you like to share some of that with us? No? Okay. What do I do at that moment? There's the pivotal point. Am I going to stay there, or at that point do I believe that restoration is possible? Lamentations 2. Hopefully you kept your place in Lamentations. And what we need to do is allow this feeling to settle in. So, how the Lord in His anger... The first verse. We're going to start at the first verse. How the Lord in His anger has set the daughter of Zion under a cloud. He has cast down from heaven to earth the splendor of Israel. He has not remembered His footstool in the day of His anger. This is... If Jeremiah is the writer of Lamentations, there's some question about that, but if he is, this is Jeremiah's description of what has just happened. There had been relationship between God and man, between God and Jerusalem. And now it says, the God who dwelled with men and men who dwelled with God, God has put that separation in place. It said, He's cast down from heaven to earth. That's a really interesting phrase. Turn over to Isaiah 14. So that you can really feel the bleakness of this. I'm going to start at the 12th verse. How you have fallen from heaven, O Daystar, son of David. How you were cut down to the ground. You who laid the nations low, you who said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. The Lord is in the right. I'm sorry, I turned a thing, a whole collection of pages. Above the stars of God, I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the Mount of Assembly. In the far reaches of the heaven, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. There's that word clouds again. So here's what Jeremiah is saying. God has chosen to put a form of separation between His beloved and Himself, almost in the same way as God put a separation between Himself and Lucifer. This is really grievous. And that cloud represents sort of a barrier. There is no more visual connection. There is a barrier between God and man now. And he's really troubled by this. Turn over to the last part of Jeremiah. The 52nd chapter. We're going to go 52, and we're going to start at verse 1. Zedekiah was 21 years old, and this is incidentally the summation. At the end of Jeremiah, this is probably like a scribal note at the end of the book, where somebody who is editing this book and putting into its final form puts a recap And so what you'd want to say is, okay, so maybe you've read through all this and you're a little confused. Here's the essence of what just happened. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. That's not the same Jeremiah. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that Jehoiakim had done. For because of the anger of the Lord, it came to a point in Jerusalem and Judah that he cast them out from his presence. So here's the picture. Jerusalem represents this ideal family circumstance where God and man dwell together. This is the pinnacle of relationship between God and man. And Jeremiah says, interprets this, or the scribes interpret this as, there came a point, there came a day after God had warned them again and again, if you persist in this way of relating to me, I am not going to be able to stomach this any longer. If you persist in this way of relating to me, I'm going to divorce you. You're not going to have a choice. I'm going to walk out on this relationship with you. At least it's going to feel that way. And so that's what it says. And because of the anger of the Lord, it came to the point in Jerusalem and Judah that he cast them out from his presence. That's a very hopeless moment. So I want you to see that. Three different texts, it kind of describes the same situation. There's a point where, and earlier in Jeremiah describes, using God's words, he says, there's going to come the point where you're going to turn to me for help against your enemies, but what you're going to find is I'm actually going to fight on the side of your enemies against you. You've betrayed the trust that I've placed in you. You've betrayed this relationship that we had, this closeness that I longed for. You have broken every bit of that, and the time is going to come where this relationship is such an offense to me that I would rather fight on the side of your enemies against you than help you to persist in the way that you're doing things. As a matter of fact, if you have time, now this is like a huge assignment, so most of you probably aren't going to do this, but if you have time, Not to be done at 5:30 in the morning, incidentally, but the book of Jeremiah makes some pretty amazing reading. And I say, don't do it at 5:30 in the morning, because there's nothing worse than trying to read prophets at 5:30 in the morning. It takes a while to get into the feel of the literature. But in order for God to feel that way, what was God's former feeling? What was God's emotion? See, for God to get... For because of the anger of the Lord. Do you get angry about relationships that you don't care about? Not as much, do you? So, when your neighbor calls you a jerk, you get angry for 5 minutes and you get over it. Or you burn his house down, one of the two. But anyway, after you get over that, when your wife calls you a jerk every day, how does that feel? And what God is saying is, this wounds me. I am hurt by this. Okay, so now we turn back over to Lamentations. And now when we turn to Lamentations, we have a sense of what's lost. And the reason I wanted you to read the book of Jeremiah so that you kind of get a feel for it is absolutely amazing when you read through that book, again and again and again, God comes to these people and says, please live a different way. Please don't do what you're doing. I really care about you, but you can't go on living this way. I care about all of you, so don't abuse the people who are poor. Seek righteousness and justice. We spent a few weeks on that whole concept of righteousness and justice. I want you to look out for everybody in the family. Please don't relate to me that way. It would be like your wife coming to you every week and saying, I'm really troubled by our relationship now. Do you think we can do something about it? And you say, yeah, we'll get around to it. Or, well, I don't think it's that bad. You really think it's that bad? And then one day your wife just walks out and you say, I guess she thought it was that bad. And it's exactly what's happening. Perhaps the people don't take it seriously. Or just as probable, the final thing, the final straw, is God says this to the final king, Zedekiah. He says, you're probably hoping that I'm going to fight on your side when the enemy comes and builds siege walls against you. Remember the part about how I'm going to fight against you? You're probably thinking I'm going to fight for you. But here's my final counsel to you. This is God's final act of attempted grace toward his people. What I would like you to do is surrender into the enemy's hands. I've already determined that the enemy is going to win. What I would like you to do is peacefully surrender. Go and give yourselves up. And if you give yourselves up, you will live. Because this season, apart from our home, Jerusalem, this season, apart from our home, this period of what we'll call enforced separation for you to think and meditate about what you've done, this is so much like a marriage relationship. This period of forced separation will be good for you. It will allow you to think about what you had and have taken for granted. And I hope that if you have some time away, you're going to really appreciate this relationship that I've given you an opportunity to have. And Zedekiah's response essentially is, no, I'm not giving up. We're going to fight to the end. And in the end, it doesn't go well for Zedekiah because he fights to the end. It says that they drag him out of the city, he and a number of his servants. Actually, it's... Who says the Bible isn't graphic? Can we read this? Yeah, let's read this. And Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon in the ninth year of his reign, in the tenth month, on the tenth day of the month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came with all his army against Jerusalem and laid siege to it. And they built siege works all around it. So the city was besieged till the 11th year of King Zedekiah, on the ninth day of the fourth month. The famine was so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. Now incidentally, if you've ever read anything about sieges, what do you know runs out? Food runs out, water runs out, it gets to be a pretty ugly place. What do people start to do? In almost every case where there is an extended siege, and I know this is kind of barbaric sounding and gross sounding, but people start to become cannibals. They'll eat anything to survive. This is why God tells them, do yourselves a favor and give up. I'm fighting on the enemy's side. On the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine was so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. Then a breach was made in the city, and all the men of war fled and went out from the city by night, by the way of the gate between the two walls. Do you understand what just happened there? The soldiers, the guys who were in charge of protecting the city, they said, wow, it ain't looking real good here. I don't know about the rest of those people. Let them figure it out for themselves. But we're busting out of this place, and we're going to make a run for it, and maybe we can get away. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho, and all his army was scattered from him. Then they captured the king and brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah, at the land of Hamath, and he passed sentence on him. The king of Babylon slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes and slaughtered all the officials of Judah at Riblah. He put out the eyes of Zedekiah and bound him in chains. And the king of Babylon took him to Babylon and put him in prison till the day of his death. That's some pretty sobering stuff. As a matter of fact, that would make a really good movie. It wouldn't make a happy movie, but you could see that would make a really good movie. What does it take for a God of love to come to the point where he allows that? How wounded does the heart of God have to be that he allows that to take place? Because again and again, it's why I say, I don't have time to read it now. Go to the book of Jeremiah and read this. God makes overture of love after overture of love. Please, We need to talk about our relationship. And the people ignore it. And in the midst of that, God still promises a restoration. To the people, through the prophet, He says, I'm going to send you away. He promises this years in advance. I know you're not going to listen to me. This is what He says. Please turn. Let's talk about this relationship. And then in the next breath, Jeremiah says, but I know you're not going to listen to me. And because you're not going to listen to me, here's what's going to happen. But when this happens, understand that I still love and care about you, and I'm going to bring your people back at some point in time. This is the most incredible love affair. I mean, when you really see it the way it is, the people are promised a restoration. But the people are only promised a restoration not because they deserve it, but because of the goodness of God. Because God is a faithful God. When you actually read this, every time I read through this particular piece of text, I feel like I'm returned to Eden. It's like Adam and Eve are asked to leave Eden, and it's like the close of a chapter of mankind's relationship with God. This is the way it was. And the last person out of the garden, would you please turn the lights off and lock the door? This chapter in humankind's relationship with God is done. And then we see the next chapter in humankind's relationship with God. And then comes a flood. And again, for the last person out, please shut off the lights and lock the door. And then God says, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to create an individual who is going to walk alongside of me, and he's going to learn to trust me, and from him I'm going to build a special family. And I'm going to interact with them in a love relationship like no other people on the face of the earth. That culminates right here in what we just read. And that's the end of the next chapter in humankind's history with God. The most marvelous and amazing thing of this whole thing is that because God is merciful and kind, and because God loves us in spite of ourselves, the more I read this, the more I'm amazed at how God has an almost maniacal love for human beings. I just flat out don't understand it. He gives us chance after chance and continues a process of restoration. And so what I want you to know today, this is the final takeaway. Because God has a heart of love towards each of us, God's hope is for restoration, even in the midst of the most difficult thing. God will walk with you through the difficulty. God is not going to pull you out of the difficulty prematurely, because the difficulty is the only way that you're going to appreciate what you had that you walked away from, and what you could have if you're willing to do the hard work to rebuild.